Bring the committee back to order. We're very pleased to have with us today former Representative Stacey Fitz with us, former co-chair of this committee, and give us an opportunity to use his institutional memory and to learn more about the act and perhaps learn more what the issues were and the thinking of the committee back in your time. Although I'm making it sound like an old time, but I go back before you anyway, so you're young in this. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to you. What we're looking to, I think, to hear from is the Wind Act, what the committee looked at, what the objectives of the committee were at the time, what goals or expectations, that kind of thing, which I think is what we're looking for.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cleveland, members of the committee. I am Stacey Fitz. I live in Pittsfield. I am here today as a former legislator, not representing anybody, anything, any company, any position. But I do appreciate the opportunity and the invite to stop in and say hi. I didn't bring guests because I did come at the last session and gave you a little bit of a present anyway. But this kind of came short notice, so I didn't get a lot of time to plan. But Julia did a very good job of kind of framing where we came from and the kinds of things that were changed when the Wind Act was passed. And I don't want to bore the committee with a complete rehash of all of that. I was trying to figure out a little bit about...
If you could give us just a brief capsule of what your role in participation was, would be helpful.
Sure. So, you know, I was elected to the legislature in 2006 for the first time, that my first session in the 122nd. And at that time, I was immediately assigned to what was then the Utilities and Energy Committee. And during that period, early on, there were a lot of discussions going on related to the Reddington Black Metal Project. And that was still in its final throes, I guess. There were hearings ongoing. I did attend, as a member of the committee, one of the hearings up in at Sugarloaf early on to kind of listen to that and try to understand a little more. And there were several interested parties that I think today have evolved into what is the Friends of Maine Mountains, the early kind of version of that that came from those projects. And what was apparent at that time and just observing was that there was a fairly congested and tangled permitting process for a wind project specifically, but somewhat as an offshoot of site law, the way site law was written. And I think with the final refusal of the Black Metal Project, Governor Baldacci at the time, in his review of that and all the other things that people had talked about, I mean, at that time, what was the predecessor to Kibbe had previously been permitted. Then the company that was going to develop it went bankrupt. That project never really got off the ground until later on when Kibbe was proposed and came back in a different form with more modern turbines and a different permitting process for that. I think the recognition by the Baldacci administration was that it would make sense to assemble a task force to look at wind power in general as an opportunity for the state. And then if that task force could come to an agreement, it had certain things that it was assigned to try to evaluate and answer. So as a member of the committee and a person who was assigned, one of the representatives assigned to the task force, we went through, as a task force typically does, they assemble, and this started in, started in May of 2007, and carried forward. That task force final report came out in February of 2008, and it met throughout that summer of 2007 through the fall, and then came together at its final meeting and voted unanimously as a task force to support the report. And one of the things trying to read through the old report, which is still available, though it's no longer available on the state's website. It was taken down with this administration. So I did find it online and printed out a fresh copy for myself, because I probably printed this thing out 10 times now. So I'm keeping the paper industry in business, too. Page 25 of that report has a conclusion on permitting wind power development in Maine. And the paragraph, I guess, that leads off, if the Wind Power Task Force is persuaded that there are a number of problems with the state's existing regulatory systems, that these problems are significant and they deserve serious attention. These problems have arisen because Maine's environmental licensing process was initially set up almost 40 years ago, long before grid-scale wind power development was seen as a viable use on the Maine, or use of the Maine landscape. The task force has observed that these problems have resulted in considerable confusion and frustration from several perspectives, including those of developers, regulators, and other decision makers, and persons who care about expediting the development of Maine's wind resources, as well as those primarily focused on maintaining Maine's special quality of place. That's kind of the framework that the task force met under. And for me, as a legislator, when I first sat and listened to the process, because I was learning as I was going along, and trying to understand, as somebody that also served as a planning board chair in Pittsfield in a previous time, that, when you're on a planning board, the one thing you don't do is spot zoning. You don't take projects individually. But the LERP process was designed to be a spot zoning process. And it specifically, as far as wind power development, it really was a spot zoning process. You pick your spot, then you go to LERP, and you try to get the zoning changed. And when I looked at, for myself, how that process worked, that it was essentially a permitting process before the permitting process. All of the same types of discussions, same analysis, same everything was done during the zoning discussion, and then the project would have to go through a second round if it finally did get through the rezoning to finally get permitted by the same body if it was in the unorganized territory, which in itself seemed redundant for me, and I'm kind of a process wonk. I look at what our legislative processes create and try to find ways to make them manageable for those who have to partake, but also for the people who have an interest in bringing those issues forward, to give everybody that opportunity, but not in a redundant over and over and over process. Let's get it out there, let's do the analysis, and come back with an answer. So one of the issues that became apparent when you look at wind power in particular, and then the various mechanisms that are built into what was then LERP, was that there were some things that were already allowed as allowed uses in LERP. And those were logging, ski areas, linear projects like power lines. Those were already allowed. You didn't have to go through that zoning process at LERP if you were going to bring one of those types of projects forward. And specifically, if you look at the linear projects or the ski areas, those oftentimes were in the same areas, potentially, that a lot of the wind projects were being proposed. So the actual mechanisms that people were, as developers or somebody looking to bring a project forward, were having to go through this lengthy, uncertain, tangled process. And as a result, I agreed with the task force. that this could be made better without eliminating the public input, without, you know, somehow superseding all of the opportunities that people have to bring their objections and their concerns forward, to allow somebody that's proposing a project. And I don't care whether it's a wind project, a ski area, or whatever it is. There's a process there, and that process shouldn't be so unknown for the person bringing it forward or the company bringing it forward that they can't anticipate any semblance of an outcome. You shouldn't have to gamble on permitting. It should be somewhat a process that you can look at the standard, meet the standard, and move to the next issue. In this regard, there was no way to do that. You also had that Fitzharmoniously thing that Juliet had brought up, that basically when the task force first met, the first thing that they had to identify was, is that a realistic standard if you're ever going to move forward and have any wind development anywhere? Can you truly be fitting harmoniously in the environment? And the answer was probably not. So that standard can always be exercised to stop something. And that just didn't make sense if you were going to actually bring forward the technology that was existing, was developing, and being improved upon as a viable resource. And I think since the Wind Act was passed, I think technologies have improved even greater. I think some of the concerns that people have raised are being addressed over time as technology improves, whether that's blade design or anything else that I've seen. But at the same time, I think we, as a legislature, looked at this when the Wind Act draft was brought forward from the task force, in the same eyes that any bill comes forward to this committee or any other committee, it basically the clock resets. I mean, the task force did its job, produced what was its opinion of the draft legislation, brought it forward through the committee process, and the committee met over several days, and I often heard that it was rammed through the legislature, and you don't get to a unanimous vote, whether it's by acclamation or otherwise, by things that are rammed through. Somebody within the body of either the Senate or the House would bring up opposition. Nobody did. Just basically went under the hammer. And, that can be good, that can be bad. I've served as a legislator for 8 years, and I saw some things go through because leadership wanted it that way. But in this case, this was vetted. As a legislator, I never felt like it wasn't. And I think the public input at the time was the people that were interested parties. I think as a state, once things are in place, new opposition shows up, those people are heard, and the process continues. And I think for the legislature, if you've got it 100% right, we could all just go home, and there'd be no need for the next legislature. So these things are going to always be here. We're never going to get them 100% right. But I do think it was a good piece of work. I think it did exactly what it set out to do as a bill, and that was to clean up a permitting process that was flawed, and then also to add protections that weren't even considered before. An example of that being for the smaller projects that don't trigger site law, they would slide under the radar under the existing rules. There really was no process for them other than at the local level. So what was added within the expedited wind law was another step for those projects where they'd have to go through certification and at least a review of setback, noise, sound, and shadow flicker, so that somebody actually looked at those things for those projects that came forward later. And that came mainly from the folks that had a significant opposition to the Freedom Project. They were built throughout this process, as were the folks in the Mars Hill area. Because those were the foundation people of what is now this fairly organized opposition to wind in general, I think. And so, I've sat through many hearings on this committee and heard a lot of the issues that people have brought forward, most of which I always personally felt were addressed in the law. That now, there were certainly things that were underway, like this noise review rule, that had to work through a process. And that process exists. If there are problems with the existing rules and setbacks, shadow flicker, scenic impact, as Juliet did say, is always going to be a difficult thing because it's in the eye of the beholder. I have personal views on how far I think one person on one ridge line should be able to control what happens on the other ridge line, even though you can see it. In my previous life, I worked in hydro development for a company that put a project on the New Hampshire-Vermont border on the Connecticut River, and Vermont was dictating what color paint could be used on the exterior of the project that sat in New Hampshire. I don't know how far that goes when you can see it, how much influence one entity has over another. But I think within the Wind Act, there was an acknowledgement of that fact and ability for that process to continue to evolve. There certainly was a recognition of the areas of national and state significance would be protected. The difficulty comes into what is an area of local significance or for individual significance. My experience has been, and I read somewhere at one point, somebody had written, don't fall in love with something that can't love you back. There's something to be said for that. And, you know, you move into an area and it looks a certain way, and progress being what it is,
Wednesday, 6 p.m.
I know as a kid I had a favorite hunting spot that I sat for many hours on this log that wasn't that far down in the woods, but it was easy to get to, and I could grab my dad's three-wheeler and get there and set. And as time went on, that area changed. And that log now has a house sitting on it. And that area is not useful for me. And I had permission to go there, and I enjoyed that and shot several deer sitting on that log. But progress being what it is, I didn't have the money to buy it. Somebody else did, and they changed the use.
Now,
I don't know how far that goes as a legislature as we examine these things and looking forward. There has to be some understanding that those who have the rights to develop or want to exploit some resource, they ought to be able to do that. That's just the Republican in me. Not to the harm of somebody else, but certainly there is a level of
Wednesday
of balance where if you own something, you ought to be able to do it, or at least go through the process to make sure that we've protected to an extent, but not just to stop everything. And I know I've had at times an adversarial relationship with those who disagree with me on the wind side. That isn't for any personal gain, that's for sure, but I have my own opinions, and I've always, as a legislator, expressed those opinions. For those who don't know what I'm doing now, since I left legislature, I'm actually in the natural gas business, so I don't have a vested interest in this discussion from a personal standpoint, nor did I ever, but though I'm on some websites as maybe being framed otherwise. But I just think that as the chair of the committee, what I always try to do is be deliberative. I know that you guys have carried that on and done a fabulous job of allowing the public their opportunity to petition the state and go through the due process that is the legislative process and come back with an answer. And sometimes those answers don't appeal to everybody.
Mr. Fitz, if I might interrupt for a moment.
Yep.
Having gone through the process the same bill is being enacted, are there certain parts of it that, now that we've had some experience with it, that you would recommend that we make changes or improvements to the bill or the act?
Well, I know that within other aspects of the legislative process that I haven't been participating in during the last session, there have been various things done to law or proposed to law. I don't really have a great opinion on whether they make sense or don't, and I wouldn't want to tell you how to make that choice, but I would, in my mind, say that I think you need to listen to the people who are out there that have the complaints, but also weigh that against the practicalities of the world of development and the fact that, you know, in some of those areas that people would like to always keep the way they are, there's also a need for economies, and those economies are driven by development in most cases. And having $1 billion or more spent in what is primarily areas that probably wouldn't have seen any development other than for wind, that's something to consider. I think that we have to allow the rulemaking processes to go the way they go, and the committee here or Natural Resources will certainly have their opportunities. But I don't have a specific issue that I think needs an immediate piece of attention. I know some have not enjoyed the goals that are in the Wind Act. They're arbitrary in some ways. If you read through the task force report, there are a variety of potential numbers that were out there. You know, the choice of 2,000 megawatts by 2020, I've lost track. Could it have been done? Yeah, it could still be done, I guess, if certain scenarios fell into place. But then, as a committee, you also have to consider transmission constraints, transmission issues elsewhere, and whether that's practical. But I don't know that changing those numbers affects a whole lot either. You know, it kind of goes all over the place. It really depends on who you talk to, and, you know, is there an opportunity to add clarity further than what's already there on the scenic issues? What was attempted to be done was be practical with the 8-mile discussion. Part of that, you know, those people might say that there weren't any analysis done. We did see renderings and photos and you know, what something would look like from 8 miles away versus 3 miles away. Those continue today in the permitting processes that exist, so that the various entities can make those choices. Noise is out there. I think the VEP has made adjustments to that. I think we have to let those things kind of play out a little bit. But specifics, I think we improve things with it, and I'm sure this legislature has an opportunity to improve things more.
Do you have other comments you want to share?
No, I'm fine. I've rambled enough.
Are there questions from members of the committee, Representative Duffy?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I actually have two or three around the specifics, Representative Fitz commented that did you work for an engineering company or you worked involved in energy, I understand, while you were a legislator. So I kind of consider you an expert. So perhaps you can answer this. Do you still think that the 2,000 megawatt goal is realistic? Or should we go back and take a look at that? We're 400 or 500 now, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate the question. The issue is whether the date is right. You know, is that too aggressive? Is it what does it do? And does it have an impact beyond at least a statement that we acknowledge that there, as a state, is a potential there? 2,000 is certainly doable in the mechanical engineering side. Whether 2,000 is doable because of organized opposition in certain areas that have boxed out potential development, I don't know. That analysis, you heard reference to the Bob Grace study. It all came as a result of a multi-level analysis of the wind resources that exist, the sites that are available, various adjustments to what the potential was and then what the likelihood based on scenic impacts and otherwise of certain areas. And that's actually a honed down number quite a bit from what the real potential was. But at the same time, you need investors to want to put that much in, and you also need to get that power to the people who want it, which also has a limiting factor that whether that's practical.
A couple more. From what I've read, part of it was to minimize our dependency on foreign oil. That was part of the justification. Can you respond to the extent that foreign oil dependency has been addressed by planning for land-based wind? And sort of going on to that, do you think that the assumptions included in the Wind Act were a bit overstated? And one more, I'll just group these all together and be done with it. I think on some of the permitting, there's a design or an installed capacity assumption, projected capacity, and actual capacity. Do you know what those numbers look like collectively for the state of Maine?
Probably on the last. That's not something that I've been involved in as far as the specifics of, the units that are there today, how they performed, whether there are other factors involved that impact what the output of those are. Some projects haven't produced as well as they probably should have because of mechanical difficulties. The same thing happened in the hydro industry in the 80s when hydro plants were being proposed and built that then turned out heavier box issues because engineering design adopted certain technologies. As far as the issue of capacity and whether we've met our or having an impact on oil or fossil fuels in general, because I think you have to kind of lump all of that together. Sometimes in the analysis, oil was the focus. I think if you look at what ISO is proposing for this winter, oil comes back into play. If capacity issues on gas are being addressed with backup oil and dual fuel, then we are going to be burning more oil. And I, as somebody that has spent a lot of time in the hydro world, that's primarily where my expertise lies. Hydro plants typically on a run-of-river basis are designed to about a 45% capacity factor. Any of the back-of-the-napkin calculations I've ever done on wind projects, they aren't viable unless you can get them to 30% capacity factor, so that's affected by resource and technology. Once you get to 30% capacity factor, the numbers start to work better.
Do we have any at 30%?
I don't know what the capacity factors are right now. I know, in the early days of Mars Hill was overproducing what they originally thought, and it had capacity factors in the early days up over 40%. Um, closer to what a standard run-of-river hydro would have. I think all of those things, you know, from the engineering side, those are questions that developers need to address, because it gets into return on investment for a developer.
If we're subsidizing it to the extent that we are, it seems like as legislators, we should have access to that information. And I know I understand there's proprietary stuff, and but they're asking, they being the industry, is asking, in my opinion, for a huge amount.
Pacific Northwest being one of the primary ones, where, you know, we like to talk about how high our energy costs are here as opposed to other places, and, you know, there's not a place in the United States that's probably more subsidized from the federal end than the Pacific Northwest. And now Tennessee Valley, not anymore. I mean, at one time Tennessee Valley was, but Tennessee Valley tends to be, you know, the original developments that created the TVA are long gone. I mean, in the overall, TVA is a much bigger animal than what was originally created. But the Bonneville Power Authority and some of the other entities that exist in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, if you try to understand why their rates are so low, they were built by the federal government. Now, if the federal government came in here today and said, we'll build 5,000 megawatts of wind, we would fight that, saying that was a bad idea. Now, in the Pacific Northwest, when they proposed to build lots of hydro, that was a good idea for them. And it changed their whole makeup and gave them Boeing and Alcoa and some of the other entities that exist there that we could never even dream of attracting. So subsidies, they're all relative, I guess. And so I've always struggled in the argument against when we're comparing ourselves to those who have been subsidized before us. I don't know how you answered all your questions, but I'll try.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to have you before our committee, Mr. Fitz, and I think there was a cookie sitter behind us for asking for you.
No, sorry. I'm not going to take credit for
those. I was trying to help you out. So a couple of things that I continue to hear from people, and I think it really comes down to people that I hear from who are opposed to wind power do not feel that they've been heard. And I think that reasonable people can disagree on that. So I wasn't, as you know, I've followed the Energy Committee on certain issues, namely efficiency, for many years, but this is my first session actually being on it. So I just want to hear from you whether you feel that the process all along was open, whether it was transparent, and whether people had an opportunity to be heard.
I never felt like the process was closed or not public, or whether it be at the task force level or when it came to the legislature in the end, or even going further beyond that over the years of all the various issues that have come forward. You know, several of the people who came to the task force, I had lunch with privately, you know, that were in just guttural opposition to the whole concept. I've always tried to make this as much an open process, if I had any influence over it, as I could. And don't always agree, and I don't think committees always agree with some of the issues that are brought forward, and that's all part of that balancing act of the process itself. I think going forward, you know, and looking at the permitting, that's certainly an extremely public process, and I don't know how anybody could ever say that they weren't given an opportunity to participate.
I have a couple questions, if that's all right. I've been sort of sitting here listening. So we hear, the other thing I hear a lot about is the subsidies. And I guess for me, that argument doesn't really hold water, largely because it's predicated, I'm sorry, I can't hear. It's predicated on the idea that we're only subsidizing wind. And it's also predicated on the idea, exclusively of direct subsidies as opposed to indirect subsidies such as externalized costs that may come with other sources of fuel. For example, coal tends to be 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which is, or thereabouts. But as we know, coal also requires, in some cases, the complete blowing up of mountaintops. More important to Maine, and more specific to Maine, we have one of the highest cancer and asthma rates in the country, and there's common sense would suggest that if we happen to be the tailpipe of the coal industry, which we are, that there may be a correlation between those two things. And so
hey,
while other part regions of the country may get lower energy costs, the externalized costs end up on Maine healthcare shoulders. So could you speak, that's a big piece of...
There's a lot there.
Yeah, could you unpack that and just speak to it based on, I mean, you've been on the committee, you were on the committee for many, many years.
You know, it does go back to the issue that we have, like, being in New England as opposed to being in Ohio. But at the same time, you know, there are other things about living in New England that are better than living in Ohio, I would hope. Not given the temperatures in the last few days. But, you know, this issue of subsidy is never going to go away. There's always somebody out there that's going to get a little more and do things. And any effort to try to capture the externalities in cost does balance us and the things that we deal with here versus what others don't want to talk about or push back from. For me, the subsidy issue, you know, specifically as far as the state goes, is probably most wrapped up in renewable portfolio standards. That's probably the biggest item. And I think if you look at our overall costs of electricity, it's a sliver in our overall costs. And we can fight about that till we're blue in the face and bruised and battered, but it won't do anything, you know, any consequence to our overall electric rate. Even if we would eliminate all of it everywhere, it's very, very small in the overall. So I don't disagree with you. I you know, it's a fact of life, and I think the only control as one legislator we typically have is how what we do for ourselves. And I know it's not necessarily always echoed in a friendly way, but, you know, Maine does have traditionally the lowest rates in New England. We're doing something right compared to our neighbors. Now, does that last forever? No, we're also at the benefit of the fact that there's some constraint there on transmission, and if we relieve the constraint, those prices will probably more equalize. We've done a pretty good job of balancing one against the other. There are so many pieces to the whole discussion, and this committee spends hours and hours and hours reviewing them each session. So.
There's also a difference in, you know, a significant federal subsidy. Thank you. Sorry, sir. I did say I had a few questions.
We tend to be more conversational.
You asked to, but you may ask me to.
I was just saying that when you look at oil and gas, it's heavily subsidized at the national level, at the federal level. And when you're competing with those, all we can do is to provide subsidies to help compete. But the last question that I have relates to the big picture. So I'm open to constructive tweaks to a policy, and I hear from opponents both some constructive pieces, but then this overarching idea that if we don't absolutely do away with any sort of industrial wind whatsoever, that we haven't done our job. And so I'd like to hear from you on that. I mean, you and I regulated the alcohol industry. I'll use one term, wine tasting, that will make both of us cringe. Every single year, there are tweaks to the bill. To the law doesn't necessarily mean that we should go back to prohibition per se. So I'd just like to hear your thoughts on, you know, the idea of constructive tweaks versus just throwing the entire wind energy industry out the window, because that's what I'm hearing from folks. And, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think
when legislators look at how they make their decisions and what they agree or disagree with that, on issues that are brought forward, polling has a lot to do with what the overall posture and mindset of people in the decision-making process. You have to consider that. And as much as it is a difficult thing, people who oppose tend to be more engaged than people who don't. So that's a piece of what drives the legislative process. That's just the realities of how things are. You know, I think, you have to let the process continue and do the best thing you can and not feel guilty about what you do later because you did that with the best information you had.
Three other New England states have placed a moratorium on wind farms. I haven't had the opportunity to verify whether or not that's correct, but if it is, can you think of some reasons why they felt it necessary to put a moratorium on their wind farms?
I mean, I've only watched what other states have done kind of from afar. I certainly, you know, when you get into some parts of this, the New England region especially, there is a lot more development that covers the bigger territory, and so there's less room for other things. Wind tends to take up space. There isn't a lot of space available in many of those states where you're not sitting right on top of somebody else, and that in itself may drive a larger contingent of people to come forward and make those suggestions. I'm not a big fan of moratoriums. I'd rather get to the issue and resolve the issue directly and not just say no to everything, but other states handle it their own way, and you know, Maine has a moratorium process that's allowed in communities for the short term while they resolve it and come up with final decisions, and I think those processes are you know, just part of what's embedded in what we do. But you know, why other states do what they do is best left to them. I can't guess beyond that.
Any other questions for Mr. Fitz? Thank you so much for your time.
I hope it was helpful. I do appreciate the opportunity to come back. I always enjoy being here, and you may see me again and wearing my other hats, but I do appreciate the opportunity, and if anybody has questions afterwards, feel free to seek me out.
Thank you, and it's great to have the opportunity to get it.